This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. As long as there have been parents, there have probably been questions about what goes on in the minds of teenagers. The pioneering American psychologist and educator Stanley Hall, who was born in the 1840s, was perhaps the first psychologist to use scientific methods to study adolescence, which he described as going through a period of Sturm und Drang between the ages of 12 and 25. I love that. That's German for storm and stress or turmoil. But it wasn't until much more recently, with the development of brain imaging technology, that scientists were able to actually see the teen brain in enough detail to compare it to more mature brains. And these images have shown us that while the brain size doesn't change much during adolescence, brains undergo extensive remodeling and rewiring between age 12 and around 23. Think network upgrade. But the brain studies that exist in this area now are relatively small. The National Institutes of Health wants to change that. This month, they launched a landmark study that will follow the biological and behavioral development of more than 10,000 children, beginning around age 9 through adolescence and into early adulthood. The University of Vermont is one of 19 centers participating in what's being called the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study. That's ABCD for short. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll talk with Alexandra Potter. She's co-principal investigator for UVM on the project. She's also a clinical assistant professor of psychology at UVM. And Matt Albaugh. He's a postdoctoral research associate on the ABCD study. Lexi Potter and Matt Albaugh, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much.
What a fascinating study. From earlier research that's been done and using the brain imaging, we know that the wiring of the brain changes a lot during adolescence. Alexi, how much is the wiring different, say, in a 15-year-old's brain versus a 25-year-old's? If you would be looking at the scans of the two brains, how would they be different?
It's a great question. There are most things are really similar, and the changes that occur are kind of subtle. It's more a shift in how strong different connections are and how efficient different processing is. So some research has shown that a 15 and a 20-year-old can solve problems equally well if the 15-year-old is given enough time and structure to kind of calm down some of those impulses and think through and use the resources they do have.
Well, and Matt, that leads me to my next question of what do researchers understand about how the wiring difference impacts how teens think? And it sounds like they think in different ways, but just need different parameters.
Yeah. Well, and so a lot of research has looked at cortical development, so kind of this outer layer of the brain, and how these structural changes relate to emotional and behavioral well-being and also cognitive ability. So a lot of my past research has looked at how there are subtle changes in the cortex and how that may map to aspects of behavior.
Well, one of the behaviors that we often associate with teens is risk-taking. Mm-hmm. What is it about the way their brains are wired and the way their brains develop that encourages more risky behavior? Lexi,
yeah.
Let me start with you.
Yeah. So in adolescence, that's probably one of our most well-known things. There's an increase in brain activity during risky behavior and associated with rewards. So adolescents are more likely to do things that are risky in order to gain reward than adults. And there's a delay in the development of that very front part of your brain that helps you think through and make rational decisions. So you have this overdriven drive towards reward and are willing to do risky things to get to that reward, and this underdriven part that controls your behavior and helps you think of, well, what could go wrong? What are other things I might want to do instead?
So when you say reward, it's like a part of the brain lighting up or being stimulated is the part that feels good and says, yes, let's jump off the cliff into the lake, even though we're not quite sure how deep it is, sort of thing.
Exactly. And everyone might see, oh, let's jump off that cliff. That looks really cool. And what happens is the adolescent is less efficient in thinking about alternative things that could happen, that could go wrong, and alternative behaviors they might do. Like, I'm going to go down and wade in that water first and make sure it's deep enough.
So how is it that some teens act very grounded and responsible and don't really engage in a lot of risky behavior, while others do. Matt, are some brains developing faster, or is that just a personality trait?
No, absolutely. And, you know, we can see this. There is variability across adolescence as far as how quickly certain parts of the brain are developing. And just like Alexi mentioned, you know, we can see this discrepancy between kind of these more emotional parts of the brain, how quickly they develop relative to parts of the prefrontal cortex. And so this is very much an aim of this study, is to kind of track the development of different parts of the brain and then relate that to aspects of behavior like risk-taking.
And because, sorry, you're absolutely right that every person is different, and it is more, you know, likely to be much more complicated than just a brain imbalance in one person compared to another. And so one of the things we're trying to do is to take a really broad look and look at all kinds of family variables and school variables and social variables and things in addition to brain variables to see if we can help figure out kind of trajectories of who are those real risk takers and who are more, you know, reasonable kids and who are overly shy and maybe could use a little more risk taking to be, you know, at their best.
Listeners, do you have teenagers? Have you noticed big changes in your kids' behavior since they entered adolescence? Are you pulling your hair out at some of the things they're doing? Or is your teen a model of responsibility? We'd love your perspective today on the program, and you can call us and join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 800-639-2211. Or if you're on your computer, go to vpr.net and click on the Vermont Edition link, and you can post your questions or thoughts there. Melissa is a seventh grade science teacher. She passed along to us some questions from her students about adolescent brains that I wanted to query you both. She's one of the questions is, why do only teen brains go through this weird stage of not thinking straight? Are there, you know, once you hit ages 24 and beyond, are there other phases of adulthood where your brain is also going through maybe later on decline? But Matt, is there any other phase?
Well, again, kind of looking at the cortex and how the cortex develops, this outer layer of the brain, we see this initial increase, and then afterwards, there is this thinning that takes place, which we think has to do with kind of a pruning process, kind of like a bonsai tree. We're kind of pruning away excess connections and refining those existing connections. And so what's interesting is kind of after we kind of see this initial growth, we then see this kind of initial decrease in thickness that persists throughout adulthood. So that process kind of continues into
a winnowing.
Exactly. Yep, that's right.
And I think you have challenges for kids, for adults, anytime there's a big discrepancy with strong connections in some parts of the brain and relatively weaker connections in others. And you see that behaviorally, like you see when your kids, you know, hit an age where they're clumsy, they can suddenly do behave, you know, when a kid toddler's learning to walk, they can suddenly walk, but they haven't got it refined yet. And that is kind of uncomfortable. And we see that emotionally often in adolescence where there's overdriven emotion and they haven't yet got it quite refined yet. And all throughout your life, as those things are kind of, as there are those differences in development, people will experience some kind of typical distress. We think about those periods in your life and that, you know, kind of related to that mismatch of abilities or development.
There's one other question here. It says, why are emotional control and decision-making the last things to develop in the brain? We kind of touched on the fact that there are different parts of the brain that are developing, but any ideas as to why those sort of more complex thoughts are the last? Matt, I'll start with you.
Well, there's some interesting evolutionary theories about, you know, why that is. And one theory is that, you know, this is supposed to kind of help the adolescent kind of break away a bit from the family. So, you know, this hasn't been proven, but it's an interesting theory as to the origin of these types of behaviors and why there is this discrepancy.
Well, Alexi, let's talk a little bit about how this study is going to be actually worked out. The ABCD study being spearheaded by the National Institutes of Health will follow 10,000 young people. So it's massive. How many will UVM be tracking and how are you recruiting for this study?
Mm-hmm. So UVM will be will be recruiting 550 9 and 10-year-olds in the next 2 years. And then that cohort of children will be followed over 10 years of their life. So we'll start when kids are 9 or 10, and they'll stay in the study until they're 20. And because one of the things that's different and really interesting about the ABCD study is it's using an epidemiological approach for recruitment. And so we're getting a nationally representative sample. And in order to do that, all of the recruitment is happening through schools because of all of our children are involved in school or in homeschooling. And so it's a way that we can get a sample of 10,000 kids that will really represent the population. So parents will hear about the study with information coming from their schools.
And Matt, walk us through how the study will actually be done. You get these 550 9 and 10-year-olds that you're going to follow through.
Yep.
You know, you fill out the forms. Okay, they're in.
Yep.
Now what?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so so we're going to have families come in. Parents will be completing a number of questionnaires. The 9 and 10-year-olds will be completing also a number of questionnaires. And then afterwards, there'll be some scanning that will take place. And so part of the visit will involve having the child go into what we call the mock scanner, which is supposed to kind of be, you know, very similar to what it's like in the actual scanner, kind of get them used to that environment. And they'll be practicing a number of cognitive tasks in this mock scanner. And then they will be doing them in the actual scanner.
To kind of get them ready for when they go
exactly.
In.
Exactly.
Because I was wondering how uncomfortable that would be for the kids and how are they going to act normal if they're in.
Yeah, we actually have had very good success with it. I always say the mock scanner is everything except the $1 million magnet. So kids can really get in and get comfortable, and we have time to talk with them about, you know, strategies they can use. And also they can see what they're doing in there. And we find that letting kids know what's going to happen really makes a big difference in their comfort level.
Listeners, you can join our conversation. We're talking about the teenage brain today. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's take a call now from Shelburne. Randy is on the line. Hi, Randy. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a comment about the variability amongst kids and their various personality types related to their behavior, risk-taking, etc. And there's a doctor in PhD at UCLA named Dario Dark that has been doing some studies about personality types and EKG, EGG. What is it when you do a brain scan?
Those EEG.
EEG, and that noting that different personality types' brains light up consistently differently, and it hopes some work would be done in your study that would acknowledge that that may be one of the variables that takes place, different personality types having a different relationship to risk, etc.
Randy, let me pick it up. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. One of the things we know about different personalities is, you know, that is one way to group kids' behavior and kind of approach of how they process information. And it is one of the variables we'll be collecting in the ABCD study. And one of the things that I think is such a great opportunity in the ABCD study is it's never as simple. We know we can look at different personality types, but that's not enough to give us, the ability to predict or to identify kids who will struggle or kids who won't. And we know that we can divide by, you know, symptoms of things like problems with attention, but that alone is not enough. So the great hope with ABCD is by having 10,000 children, we can use these different variables like personality style and, you know, mental health issues they may have and whether or not they do, you know, after school activities and combine all of the data to see if we can learn about how kids can do well.
We got a post from NLPNT. Is there a correlation between having the opportunity to make decisions and development of the decision-making skills? And the question is, are helicopter-parented teens less developed than those who were less sheltered, which I think is a really interesting question. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, some of the work I've done before has looked at different parenting styles and how that may actually help to shape children's brains, and so that is one thing we see. One area that I'm very interested in is looking at anxiety in children, and that's something that's very, very common. Anxious kids tend to have parents that tend to kind of be more in this kind of helicopter parenting fashion, and there is some evidence to suggest that parents that kind of prevent opportunities for kids to actually regulate themselves, that might affect neurodevelopment, particularly in these emotion regulatory circuits.
Again, listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about a landmark new study that's being launched this month to examine the adolescent brain. 10,000 young people, the youngest around age 9, will take part. The National Institutes of Health is overseeing the project, and UVM is one of a number of research centers taking part. My guests today are Alexandra Potter. She's a PhD and co-principal investigator for UVM on the project. She's also a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at UVM. Matt Alba is a postdoctoral research associate on the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So we were talking about how parenting styles might affect brain development. What about things? How are you going to factor in things like sleep patterns, exercise, exposure to drugs and alcohol, and things like that?
Yeah, and that really – that is the biggest reason for this study. Studies that have been done in the past will focus on any one of those things. So let's look at adolescent sleep, and we'll do small studies that look at, cross-sectionally about sleep. But what we don't have is a large-scale study over time to say, how does sleep actually impact the brain at different phases in development? And is it as simple as more sleep is better? Likely not. Likely there are kids for whom sleep is a critical variable and kids for whom sleep is important, but it may not be as important. And the same thing in terms of, we talked about parenting, a lot of it is the match between the child and the parenting style. It's not that there's a good parenting style and a bad parenting style, but parenting your kid to meet their needs is really the critical variable.
Were there any kids or adolescents that you did not want to include in this study? Were there any medical conditions you were trying to avoid or
We've taken a very, very practical approach to this problem. The short answer is if a kid can complete the protocol and they don't have something that would affect their brain structure or blood flow to the brain, they will be included in the study. So we're not screening out for any particular disorder. And again, with 10,000 kids, we feel like we can responsibly do that and still have very valid data.
1-800-639-2211, our number, if you have a question or a comment about the teenage brain. If you're just joining us, that is our topic today. Researchers at UVM are taking part in a landmark new study that's kicking off this month to help people better understand just how those changes in wiring affect behavior. Courtney wrote in, how might this research inform how we interact and communicate with and schedule teens' lives to optimize their capacity to learn and thrive? That's a
great question. And one of the things that I think is really important is to recognize that in adolescence, there is this mismatch between a drive for risk and for new behavior and an underdeveloped skill to really slow down and think through the consequences. And what that tells me is that we still need to parent our adolescents. We still need to help them to make decisions, to help them to see the impact of their behavior while allowing them new experiences and the freedom to make decisions and to make mistakes. That's part of how we all learn. And they've shown that actually very clearly in brain development, is that the skills that you practice are those areas of your brain that grow stronger. And so giving them safe ways to try out their independence, but still remembering to parent and help them set and set limits for them are both important in adolescence.
Letitia in Bennington contacted us and wanted to know if this study will help with whether or not we should continue state and federal standardized testing.
My guess is that it won't really help with that, only because all kids in the United States are having standardized testing. So we wouldn't have a way to know, you know, is it better for, you know, is there differences for kids who do or do not get standardized testing? But I think this will give us a lot of information about educational practices. It's another thing we can look at, variables related to schools, and to see if different kind of school level variables make a difference for kids' outcomes.
Parents out there of teenagers, I know you've rolled your eyes in the past at some of the things your teenagers have done. Some of you out there may be thinking, you know, my teens are pretty good. They follow the rules. It's not so bad. We would love to hear your thoughts and questions about how the teenage brain works, how it's different. That's our topic today. My guests are Matt Albaugh. He's a postdoctoral research associate at UVM, and Alexandra Potter. She's co-principal investigator on the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study that UVM is taking part in. They're kicking that study off this month. We will take more of your calls and questions and continue this conversation after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and this is Vermont Edition. Your normally mild-mannered 16-year-old son has just been arrested for shoplifting, or your daughter who runs track and is on honor roll tells you she's pregnant. Teenagers can be full of surprises, and sometimes their behavior can be shocking. Today on Vermont Edition, we're talking about what is and is not known about the teenage brain, why it takes longer than we think to mature, and how that may be affecting how your child behaves and the decisions he or she makes. My guests today on the program are Matt Albaugh. He's a postdoctoral research associate at UVM, and Alexandra Potter. She's co-principal investigator on the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study. It's a new landmark study that UVM is launching this month to help scientists better understand how teenage brains work. You can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211 or post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We've got a call from John now, who's checking in from Richmond. Hi, John. Welcome to Switchboard. That dates me. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I have a quick question. I have three kids from 16 to 23, and they all have distinctive learning styles. And I was just wondering if the study takes into account how adolescents, young people, process information, and whether there's any interest or looking at physiological differences in the brains of the kids who are being evaluated.
Huh.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that is really great about the types of brain imaging that we are doing, is we'll be able to see individual differences in how kids process information at the brain level. And, you know, you're right, every kid kind of approaches problems different, and you can kind of see how they untangle information and put things together. And yet we also see these patterns that really follow developmental milestones in terms of, you know, how impulsive a decision is made or how risk averse a child is. And so I think we'll be able to kind of look at that in two ways, look at those unique variables, and also see, are there patterns that relate to how they process information?
John talked about having a number of children, and I'm wondering, in this study, Matt, are you going to have siblings or any identical twins or that sort of thing to assess that?
Yep. At some sites, they will be recruiting twin pairs. And so there's obviously interest around twin pairs because it allows you to try to disentangle kind of the relative genetic component to some of these behaviors versus more environmental effects.
What role do hormones play in brain development? I'll start with that question because that kind of goes off on different tangents. But what role do hormones play?
Yeah, I mean, they have a very important role, and we know that during adolescence, there's suddenly, you know, this surge in hormones that kind of correspond with the developmental changes that are happening. But one of the things, again, about the study is that we'll be able to answer that question in ways we've never been able to answer it before, because we'll have a cohort of children who are starting the study before puberty that will follow until they're young adults, and we'll get a much better idea of that. And we're collecting saliva samples to get hormone levels as we see kids. So we'll see every child every year, and they'll do brain imaging every other year, but every year we'll be able to get a sample of what their behavior is like, how their cognitive performance is, how their brains are functioning on that level, and also things like hormones.
So what are the biggest, when you look at the body of research that's out there right now, we mentioned that there's not that much of it, and this the whole purpose of this landmark study is just to expand the research base, the database. But what are the biggest gaps in the research that exists now where people say, oh, we really need to understand this better? Matt?
I think, you know, a growing field is really looking at how what's called functional connectivity, so how different brain areas are talking to one another, how that kind of unfolds over development, and kind of how these changes may be relevant to certain aspects of behavior. So, you know, kind of one huge goal here would be to, you know, much like a pediatrician has a growth chart for early kind of bodily development, to maybe work towards developing a brain chart, if you will, to kind of help maybe identify early on kids that may be more prone to certain emotional and behavioral struggles.
Right, because we don't have that large database of normal development, it's very hard to know if the markers we see are important or not. So we can do studies of looking at, you know, kids with attention problems compared to kids without attention problems, and we can see differences. But what we don't have is a large-scale study to say, well, what would this look like normally? What percentage of kids have these differences and don't have attention problems? And this study will let us really start to answer how important are some of the differences that we see.
I just ask you about hormones, and I'm also wondering, is there any difference in the way or the speed that boys' and girls' brains develop? You know, is there a different rate where if you take, you know, at 17, at 18 differences? You're both nodding, so I know this, and this can be a touchy subject, you know. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's actually funny. There's a postdoc in the lab right now that's looking at this, Dr. Catherine Orr. So there are some, you know, some known gross differences. So males in general having relatively larger brains, but kind of trying to figure out what the functional implication of that is and how that relates to pubertal development as well. Females in general tend to develop a little bit faster relative to males. So again, you know, with the existing literature, some of these factors really haven't been teased out, you know, as far as the role that pubertal stage may have on brain development versus just, you know, sex in general. So there's a lot of areas for investigation here.
This NIH study is being done in what I understand is an open science model, so that the data will be made available to the public within months of being collected, obviously anonymous data. But I understand this is pretty unusual with studies, and I'm wondering, Alexi, why did NIH want to put the data out there?
Yep. So the study, the way the study was developed, it was a competitive process, and we were part of a consortium of sites. So Dr. Hugh Garavan worked with our, who's at UVM, put in our original application. And so while it's a NIH funded study, and they certainly are giving some design to it, the scientists within the consortium really did design the data collection elements. But one of the things that NIH is pushing hard and that we're in agreement with is this need for open science, and that once we could take all identifying information off the data, it is made available. And what that really does is it allows scientists access to the data who don't have the resources to conduct this large study. And, you know, we really feel like there's so much information and questions to be answered that we can share, that we can share all the information. People can download it and analyze and publish it on their own.
When you look at research on adolescent brains that used brain imaging technology, how far back do those studies go? When did those first start being done? Matt, do you have any idea?
So just large scale?
Not large scale, but just any. I mean, well, when were the first? Was it early 90s? Or I'm trying
MRI itself is incredibly young. It's a young science. I think first images were in the mid-80s, first images at all. And because of that, our analytic methods are still really young. And that's another thing that's really – what we've recognized is we can really benefit from using statistical methods from other fields, from mathematics, from computer science, from some of these other areas that have figured out how to approach these really big, complicated data sets. And the open science method really allows us to do that, allows people who maybe aren't neuroscientists to have access to the data to collaborate with us to figuring out some of these things.
Well, and I ask that question because it's there's so much that's happened as far as, you know, the internet, social media, the way teenagers interact today compared to the early 90s is completely different. And I'm wondering how, you know, the way social media impacts interactions amongst teens, if there'll be any interesting correlations in the way our brains are wired.
Yeah, it's such an unknown area. Something that we're very interested in collecting on kids is how they are using social media and how that interacts with their risk-taking and their brain development.
And I guess final question, you know, 10 or 20 years from now when you've got this data, Matt, let me throw this to you. How do you hope that this research could be used diagnostically or maybe predictively?
So as a clinician, you know, one of my big hopes would be that this information could be used to help identify kids that might be at greatest risk for certain emotional and behavioral struggles. So really using kind of, using these data that we're collecting to maybe in turn help identify kids that really might struggle during their adolescent years.
And also to develop best practices for all kids. You asked the questions about sleep. We hear a lot about exercise and sports and nutrition, and this study will give us data to help guide how to parent our kids.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about this study as it progresses. Alexandra Potter is co-principal investigator on the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study. Matt Alba is a postdoctoral research associate on the ABCD study. Matt and Alexi, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Still to come, the winner of this year's Vermont Book Award. There were nine finalists, and poet Major Jackson was named the winner at a gala dinner this weekend. We'll talk with Major Jackson next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack. The winner of this year's Vermont Book Award was announced on Saturday night at a gala at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. This is a relatively new award. It's only in its second year, and VCFA created it to honor literature and writers that have a strong connection to Vermont. And we're so pleased to share that this year's award went to poet Major Jackson, and he joins us now. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So, nine writers were finalists for this year's award, and I'm wondering, how did it feel to have your name announced this weekend?
Well, it was actually quite shocking, even though one is nominated for these sorts of things. It's hard to imagine actually winning, and I'm actually quite shocked and humbled and deeply honored, particularly to be among friends and writers whose work I deeply admire, some of whom I actually have learned from. So I was aghast with immense kind of joy and pleasure and excited.
Last year's winner was also a poet, Karen McAdden. I'm wondering if that is exciting for you as a poet to know that here's this new award and the first and second year winners have been for poetry writers.
Well, there's a joke among us writers that poetry is the oldest and most distinguished literary art form. We like ribbing each other in that regard. But I think the fiction writing and the nonfiction that Vermont writers produce is actually extraordinary and exceptional. And all of the finalists represent to me the full range of the kind of writing that happens here in Vermont. And all of them are deserving of recognition in their own their own awards.
You received this award for your 2015 book of poetry, Roll Deep. The themes of travel, history, and class are prominent in this volume. Why were you drawn to those ideas?
Well, I've spent a number of years in Philadelphia, and I've also traveled much of the U.S. I've lived and traveled quite a bit. And it seems like, to me, the most pressing issues of our times have revolved around those particular themes. And I think this election season has somewhat underscored that. And I'm very interested in having a conversation outside of the political rhetoric that gets at to real stories of human beings who kind of face these challenges of being working class or being of not of a dominant race in this country, or who are immigrants, but put that in a larger context of what does it mean for us to be human.
You said something when you were on Vermont Edition last fall with Jane Lindholm that struck me. You were talking, as a professor of literature, you strive to teach your students how important words are. And I think you said something about how maybe disheartening it was during a presidential campaign season to hear how, I think you said, words were abused and sort of thrown around, almost defaced. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that throughout this campaign season, the use of words.
Yeah, it was part of my speech as well, my acceptance speech for the award. And for me, I think writers probably carry an even greater responsibility to be responsible with language, particularly language that does not have us devalue each other or dehumanize each other, but to write in such a way that we have a greater regard for humanity. And we all know that someone is going to be victimized or to be the victim of the assault of language. Someone's going to be scapegoated. And to some extent, I think it's important for writers, but all artists, to kind of envision a world outside of that kind of rhetoric, that kind of abusive language.
You grew up in Philadelphia, went to Catholic school, I read, and studied accounting in college. And I'm wondering, you know, now that you're a poet, when you think back to studying accounting, was that something that you sat around the dinner table with your family and they said, we know you like to write, but we need you to do something practical? Or did you have a love for accounting as well as a love for words?
That was probably me standing around looking at my bank accounts. Yes, I mean, I'm one of those left brain, right brain people. I was always attracted to the order of numbers. But I realized that so much of the people who made me I am today were people who were deeply passionate about the kinds of conversation that happened in the classroom around literature. And so while I was taking those business courses, I was taking as my, what we used to call kind of free classes, were all literary-based classes. And so I kind of had a dual education going on at the same time. And those writers, I mean, those teachers were also people who were very passionate about politics and very passionate about humanitarianism. And they also were involved in social justice work as well. So they were my models, and so being in the world of accountancy to some extent did not speak to the kind of full aspect of who I am. So it's not surprising that I eventually gravitated away from that world.
You've described that your poetry as a college student was political and focused on identity, and through your graduate work you became more introspective. You've been in Vermont a long time, and I'm wondering, have you written recently about what it's like for you to be a Black man in Burlington, Vermont?
Some of those poems are in Roll Deep, for sure, and increasingly it's becoming a kind of subject matter that I am interested in writing in. But I'm also, I also kind of embrace all aspects of what it means to be a Vermonter, and so, and what does it mean to be me? And my fear to some extent is that that is the dominant narrative that people will read when they read my poetry. And I want that, but I also want a more kind of complex understanding of who I am rather than that that lens alone. That lens is definitely, is evident even in, even when I'm not writing about race. Race is present. So if I'm writing a poem about hiking Mount Philo, trust me, you, someone's going to think, oh, this is a black man writing about hiking up a mountain. You know, what sorts of symbolisms does that carry? So it's already there. I guess you could say I address it directly and indirectly.
Well, for listeners who are hearing this interview and may not be as familiar with your poetry, and for listeners that want to hear Major Jackson read some poetry, we'll have a link to his appearance on Vermont Edition last fall when he did. Describe what your poetry style is like, if you have a style. I know you're kind of always evolving, but how would you describe your style for people out there saying, huh?
I think for, you know, I write poems for my family and my grandparents, so there's poems that rhyme, but there's also poems that are, as Emily Dickinson tells us, to tell it slant. So there are poems that are very, very accessible, and then there are poems that are about travel that are more kind of collaged and associative. I would say ultimately, though, I'm very invested in creating images in a reader's mind. And so a lot of my work is driven by sound and imagery.
I remember hearing you describe poetry during an interview as a conversation. And I thought, what an interesting way to put it. You know, when I read a short story or a novel, I don't think of it as a conversation. I think of getting carried away in the story. But yes, when you read a poem, it is like a conversation. So I look forward to reading a lot more of your poetry, and congratulations again on your award.
Thank you.
Major Jackson is a poet and professor at the University of Vermont. His poetry has received many, many awards, and added to that list this weekend is the Vermont Book Award. This is Vermont Edition. And while lovers of poetry in Vermont are celebrating Major Jackson, they're also mourning the passing of Vermont poet and playwright David Budbill. Budbill died this weekend. He's remembered best for his play Judevine, set in a poor mountain town in rural Vermont. He'd been dealing with a degenerative condition that he described as a rare form of Parkinson's disease. Budbill spoke candidly with Vermont Edition's Jane Lindholm this summer about what it was like for him to experience his declining health. For instance, he spoke of how he missed chores like cutting and stacking wood.
There's lots of things I did, that I don't do anymore, like cut wood.
Do you miss cutting wood at all?
Oh, I miss it terrifically. It was one of my favorite things to do.
I've always gotten that sense from you. And, you know, for so many people, it's a chore that you do and you try to find some ability to, maybe as you have, find a little bit of zen in it, but not something that people would miss if they got rid of. But it is something you miss.
Oh, it certainly is. I am not one of those people who doesn't miss it. I miss it terrifically. I miss all parts of it. I miss the dirty, sweaty, oil and gas-stained clothes. I miss walking to the woods. I miss cutting the wood. I miss everything about it. Limbing it up, even stacking the brush, which is the least favorite thing to do. I like all parts of it.
I think you're the only person I know who's written so eloquently and lovingly about stacking wood.
Oh, really? Well, that's too bad, because I think it's one of the great joys of life. I get such a sense of satisfaction when the woodshed is full. and we're ready for winter.
That's Vermont poet and playwright David Budbill speaking this summer with Vermont Edition. He died this weekend at age 76. And that's it for Vermont Edition today. Tomorrow on the program, the challenges facing dairy farmers. We'll look at why the milk market fluctuates and why additional pressures are making this a difficult summer for some farms. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.